Phone check. 1, 2, the microphone check. 1, 2, 1, 2, the microphone check. I got my headphones tuned between two different AM stations, and my briefcase is full of declassified information. Declassified, declassified, and I'm reading it under the lens of your radio. I'm dissecting it and bleeding it. I read the world for breakfast, and after lunch I write it. I let me get me down, and then I stand back up and fight it. I read the news today, oh boy, oh boy. I know linguistics, statistics, pundits, and mystics. I voted for Ralph Nader, I read Docs and Raider, I got 1,000 signatures and sent them to Darth Vader. I'm reading U.S. News and World Report, Time Life, and The Post. I know more than other DJs because I read the most. And when I squint to the west, I can see Afghanistan. I put my head between my knees and I can see Iran. I get documents online and then I analyze them. They know I'm out there waiting so they don't declassify them. I bug the White House and I bug the Pentagon. In the filling in my molar, I got my descrambler on. I got the truth. I got Paul Muth. We got better lines than Haydn Carruth. We put our 11 cents in, just like Marx and Lenin. Paul's like Carl McCartney, but I'm John Lennon. We'd love to turn you on. I say I want a revolution, and I want to stop it all. I finished all 3 volumes up of Marx's Capital. You know, everything that old boy wrote is up on my shelf, and every single bit I translated myself. I'm reading and I'm learning, and when the tide is turning, it'll warm my heart in part to see the dollar bills burning. They weren't built in a day, but all roads lead to Rome. I'll do fine just as the Romans with my main man, Rome. I'd like to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome whose name was Chomsky. I'm MCS of the Rook. I got a voice like milk. I'm the best dressed man you ever heard. Can you hear this tie? It's silk.
It's mid-morning on the last day of the week, and you're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Estabrook and Paul Muth discussing the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Archives of this show in free software formats are available at newsfromneptune.com. Thanks to the technical expertise of Dr. No, Jeff Nicholson Owens.
We have a guest today. I'm happy to welcome to News from Neptune Anna Balzer, who's been in town under the auspices of AWARE, the anti-war, anti-racism effort, and co-sponsored by a good number of other groups around town and on campus. She's been here giving a series of talks in various places about town. Look generally fresh and refreshed, Anna, in spite of having put up with local audiences for the last 3 days or so. How's it been?
How have you found it?
Have you found Champaign-Urbana?
Champaign-Urbana, just great. I've had 2 excellent evening presentations, as well as some book signings and a couple radio gigs, and it's been nice, a nice sort of diverse 3 days, so I've enjoyed it. I've been on the road now for more than 3 months, and almost 100 presentations behind me, but I'm still trying to keep it fresh.
That's good. I'm road weary. I've just been back from my preemptive strike on Mother's Day. I decided to go in advance of Mother's Day, and so I actually didn't know anything about it. I saw a little discourse on one of the Peace Discuss lists, mm-hmm. but... What's the name of your book, and who's the publisher?
The book is called Witness in Palestine, Journal of a Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories.
Are you with PSM?
I'm with the International Women's Peace Service, a human rights organization based in the West Bank of the Occupied Palestinian territories.
You know some people with the Palestine Solidarity Movement. Am I getting that right?
Oh, yeah, the International Solidarity Movement, probably, the ISM.
ISM, okay.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I know people in lots of groups working over there, but... Yeah, but the talk I've been giving is called Life in Occupied Palestine, Eyewitness Stories and Photos.
Mm-hmm. This week, was it this week or last, that Amy Goodman covered the brouhaha in Boston at...
At Brandeis.
Brandeis,
yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess the exhibit is up at MIT. So really, 100 talks in how long?
Just about, in about 3 months. I've done a big old tour around the U.S., starting in Colorado, going south up to the Northeast, and now across through the Midwest.
How long did you live in which occupied territories?
I was in the West Bank for about 5 months. I've been there off and on for 3 years, and just a few months at a time kind of thing.
I see. But you didn't get to Gaza or before?
I haven't been to Gaza, no. Mm. No.
So any particular locales? If you were there and gone, you probably got around some. Were you in places like Hebron?
Yeah. In fact, we were based, our group is based in the West Bank, in a small village in the West Bank, in the Salfit region, a rural region up between Nablus and Ramallah. But we get around a lot because we commute sort of from that village to different areas, depending on what's happening on the actions happening that day. If there's a demonstration down near Hebron, we might make the trek all the way down there. If there are meetings in Jerusalem, Ramallah, we might go down to those. If there are farmers who'd like accompaniment to their fields and groves because they've received threats from settlers or soldiers, for example, we might accompany them right there in the Salfit region. So it really depends on what's going on.
You have a list of questions. I was going to just go on and ask if you went into some of the outposts, as some people call them, like Ariel, the one up on the hill. Well, they're all up on the hill, aren't they?
In fact, on his presentations around town, one of the themes, such as at the mosque last night, were some striking pictures of the outposts and the settlements, and drew an interesting distinction on it between outposts and settlements and how they have developed. Maybe you're going to say a word about that.
Sure. It's easy to get them confused. They're both forms of sort of colonies that have been built for only Jewish people on Palestinian land in the territories. One of the main differences is that the majority of people living in the settlements, which tend to be larger, are often going to be what are called economic settlers, meaning settlers who are moving to the territories because Israel offers financial incentives, sort of subsidizes people to move onto this Palestinian land. Meanwhile, the people living in the outposts and some of the settlements as well, about 20% of the population are called oftentimes ideological settlers, moving there for sort of their beliefs, believing a lot of them that the land in the West Bank and Gaza belongs to the Jewish people. And so there is this kind of difference. The settlements, a lot of them, the people living in them aren't necessarily there kind of because they think that this land is theirs and no one else's, but because they're looking for kind of higher standards of living, poor Israelis are moving there, low-income Israelis Jewish people who are immigrating from countries in Africa, in Eastern Europe. That said, there are certain similarities. I mean, they're both occupying land illegally, according to international law, and settlements and outposts have become very disruptive to Palestinian life, not only occupying farmers' land, but also actually there was an incident I went to an action about in which an outpost, which is part of a larger settlement, had actually taken barley seeds and boiled them in rat poison and spread the poison around the landscape of that particular area, which is near the village of Atawani, just south of Hebron. And essentially they were trying to poison animals that shepherds would bring to graze on their land in an effort to discourage villagers and farmers from going to their land. And
well, it's an economic attack in a way too.
Yeah, economic, you know, ecological.
Their food away from them, yeah.
That's right. That's exactly right. But I visited a few settlements. It's quite dangerous to visit an outpost. A lot of the settlers living in them, because they're quite small and oftentimes more militant, sort of more fundamentalist, and because they are not yet outwardly subsidized by the Israeli government, there is not as much state protection. So a lot of the protection comes from security guards who, from the outpost itself, carrying these large weapons that they can use to threaten Palestinians, internationals, Israelis. I've seen Israelis who were beaten up as well. But I did visit a few settlements, almost sort of undercover, trying to understand what was happening in them, as well as where they were intending to expand. And I did a few interviews with a few mayors of some settlements, including Ariel, actually, to try and understand sort of what their intentions were.
Now, you made the interesting point in your talk that the sort of economic settlers, the folks who come because of the benefits offered to people who come to the settlements, often Eastern Europeans. You had one striking poster of a picture of two happy little kids, and the poster said, 100,000 shekels, I think it was, to come and settle
exactly.
here. You know,
that's right. That's more than $20,000 that Israel was offering at that point in time a few years ago to anyone who would move to Ariel, which is the second largest settlement in the West Bank. And Ariel, for example, is populated primarily by immigrants from Eastern Europe who have, many of them come to take advantage of the financial incentives. Mortgages can be subsidized. Transportation is subsidized there. There are, you know, nice parks for kids, strip malls, swimming pools, the whole works. But all of this built on Palestinian land.
Yeah, and that one is, that's a fairly established from the photos I've seen of it being up on the hill. It's fairly large. So I guess another thing about it is it's outposts are just thought of as being kind of smaller. I also think
you
of
should see,
of the
actually, you should see Anna's photograph, her own photographs of it. The photographs are quite striking. I mean, it could be a real estate brochure. You know,
do you have them up on the web so that
I
our
do.
Listeners could?
My
why
website.
Don't you give us that?
Yeah, I have on my website, first of all, photographs, my writings, access to buying my book, my DVD of the presentation, my tour, schedule details, etc., as well as a way to contact me. And that that website is AnnaInTheMiddleEast.com. That's A-N-N-A in the Middle East, all one word, .com. And there you can find all kinds of
very personal
good
approach
photos. Yeah.
Easy to remember, though. That's a good part about it. Yeah.
I wanted to go back to this question of the occupants of the settlements and the outposts. You also observed, Anna, that the that perhaps 80% of the folks in the settlements have indicated that if it becomes financially possible, they would move. They would leave the settlements.
Yeah, according to United Nations OCHA, Humanitarian Affairs Office, polls, actually 80% of the settlers would leave if they were offered financial compensation to do so. And so when a lot of times when you hear things like Israel saying, well, it's just impossible to make these settlers leave, well, 20% of the settler population does indicate that they would resist in some way, like we saw in Gaza, for example, or in Hebron right now, and that it's such a large population of settlers to begin with. There are more than 400,000 right now. So, you know, 1/5 is still a lot, but to say that somehow it's just impossible to move settlers out and to simultaneously be moving more settlers and to literally be paying people mm-hmm. to leave their homes in Israel to go live on somebody else's land is inexcusable, and it's
Do you notice that the more ideological settlers are, a lot of them are more American and European?
I was just going to ask the
British,
same thing. Who are these people?
Yeah, it's funny. You'll hear them talking with, you know, their Brooklyn, you know, New York accents.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them have gone from the U.S. over to the territories. A lot of them believing that they're sort of kind of the martyrs. You'll have some of the more extremist settlers who have come. They have many children, you know, 10 children. They and their families live in these outposts oftentimes and feel that they're kind of martyrs for the Jewish people, preserving the Jewish people's sort of claim on this land. When in, according to international law, human rights as well, the Palestinians should be able to get to that land.
It's theirs. If I might, can we have sort of a background and then an update on what's going on in Hebron right now, if you just referred to something?
I mean, I'm familiar with the Hebron situation in general. I've been touring all around that I don't get to keep up as much as I'd like to. But essentially, the situation in Hebron is even more dramatic than in most parts of the West Bank because the settlers are living not... generally, they'll settle sort of around Palestinian areas to,
high
first
ground,
of all, prevent
yeah.
development as well as just to confiscate the land that belongs to farmers from these villages and towns, or to just kind of get as much land as possible. Whereas the situation in Hebron is that the settlers them, or the outposts themselves are actually within the city itself. So you have a city of several hundred, I think it is 200,000 to 300,000Palestinians in Hebron, living in Hebron. Then you have you have about 300 to 400, I believe. I hope I'm getting these numbers right. 300 to 400 settlers settled on this in this city. And then you have, I think it is 2,000 to 3,000 soldiers who've come to protect those, you know, few right. hundred settlers. And so, of course, things get very pretty bad. And in fact, what's the Hebron settlers not only have settled sort of on top of the Hebron Old City, but even have forced families from their homes, moving into sort of occupying Palestinian families' homes in the Old City, oftentimes the second floors of homes, so that they'll actually throw trash and even urinate down into into the sort of the marketplace, the market area. The Hebron market in Old City used to be a very sort of thriving, bustling Arab marketplace, and now it's pretty much abandoned. You can see trash hanging down from the tops. They've had to hang netting to catch all the trash that settlers have been throwing down. So recently, what's happened is, as I understand it, there were some clashes actually between the army and the settlers. The army actually being there to protect the settlers, and as the army is now evacuating a few of these settlers. But what's interesting is how much we hear about this. It's sort of typical. I think it is a few dozen settlers being removed.
So they didn't think the army was vigorous enough in protecting them, or they were taking the trash down, or something.
I don't know. I don't know what the circumstances were. Or if the army actually started cracking down a little bit more. I mean, the settlers, many of them are not held accountable for their actions, they've killed Palestinians, they've beaten people up, they've poked people's eyes out. I mean, they throw stones routinely at the Palestinians, the Palestinian kids on their way to school in Hebron. There are actual Christian peacemaker teams that are stationed to accompany children to school because of the stone problem. But essentially, what's happening now is that we're hearing a lot about this Hebron evacuation, just like we heard a whole lot about the Gaza evacuation. The thing about the Gaza evacuation, for example, is that indeed, you know, 8,000 settlers were removed from their homes in Gaza. And that was all the settlers in Gaza, but that only represented at the time 8 out of 425,000 settlers living in these territories. And what people, so they were a small minority. And even more interestingly is that during the time that these 8,000 settlers were being removed from their homes, homes for 13,000 new settlers were being built in the West Bank and East Jerusalem that settlers are moving into now. The settler population has grown actually by 5,000 or grew during the months leading up to and the evacuation of Gaza itself. Similarly, what you have right now in Hebron, you know, a few dozen settlers are being removed. Okay, good for the Palestinian families' homes that they were occupying. Is the settler population actually being dealt with in Hebron? I'm sure during the time that those few dozen are being evacuated, several more dozen are being moved in with financial incentives into East Jerusalem and the West Bank. It's really hard to keep things in perspective when you just look at the media and what they choose to report.
Mm-hmm. And that was clearly the plan, too. The Gaza withdrawal, such as it was precisely an occasion for the expansions of settlements in the West Bank.
I think it's pretty clear. I mean, just for people to be clear as well, that the occupation of Gaza itself has not ended officially. The settlers have left, the soldiers are out. I'm sure that things are a little bit easier on that level, just in terms of where people can go, but they still aren't able to go everywhere. I mean, for example, there's what's called a free fire zone in certain parts of Gaza, where if you go there, you can just be shot. You're just not allowed to go there, and it's controlled by snipers around and worse, around the borders of Gaza. And so a lot of people think that the occupation is over there. It's not far from that. In fact, they've closed a lot of the crossings, preventing food and medical supplies from getting through. The main crossing of Gaza has been mostly closed for most of this year, such that Gazans had run out of wheat a few weeks ago. Literally, no more bread for 1.3 million people. Gas is now being cut off. I mean, I've stopped looking at the headlines, you know, talking about the evacuation, looking at and what people are saying and looking at what people are actually doing. I mean, Israel keeps talking about how much it wants peace and safety, security, but what are its actions? What is it actually doing? That's my new standard of judging what's happening in the Middle East.
Anna Balzer,
in the Middle East is the website.
Yeah,
right?
.com.
Uh-huh. And what was the group that you're
International Women's Peace Service, and their website is iwps.info.
Okay.
How did you get involved with them in the first place, Anna? Tell us about your own odyssey that took you to the West Bank.
Well, I am a Jewish American, and I. I got into this work while I was teaching in Turkey, teaching English, and I would sort of take trips through the Middle East during my vacations, and was taken in by families all over the Middle East, in Iran and Syria and Lebanon. And wow. Through my friendships with the families that I met there, I began to hear for the first time this whole sort of different version of the history and present of Israel and Palestine, utterly different from anything that I'd ever learned growing up as a Jewish American. And obviously, I didn't believe any of it. I thought it was propaganda and lies, but it kind of planted a seed. And at that point, I began to do some of my own research. And through my research, I began to going to what are called report backs, sort of what I do, kind of coming back, someone who's been there coming back and sharing stories. Because as I mentioned, a lot of times these stories don't get into the mainstream media sources, so people don't hear them. And at one of them, I was hearing someone talk, and I sort of weakly rose my hand and said, I'm thinking of going to Palestine. And the woman there was insightful. She's actually part of IWPS, and she said, you would be perfect for this group that I know of. And so I worked with her. She interviewed me, and eventually I was accepted to work with the organization in the West Bank.
I have a strange question about Iran. Did you get a passport stamp, and when you went into Israel proper, did they look at you funny because you had an Iranian stamp on your passport?
As far as I know, the passport stigma thing is the reverse, and I've heard a few people say the opposite, but I don't think it's the case that if you have a stamp, an Israeli stamp in your passport, then you're prevented from going to Iran, from Syria, Lebanon, a few other countries perhaps as well within the Arab world. And plus Iran, but I myself, for example, one of the times I went to Palestine, I had traveled via Syria and Lebanon, that trip I was talking to you about, and Iran, and I had those stamps in my passport, and they let me in. So it's predominantly going in the other direction, and the way you deal with that, I mean, is Israel will, if you ask them not to stamp your passport,
stamp something and put it in. Loose.
Yeah, that's right. They'll stamp a piece of paper, so they're
right,
accommodating
to
that extent.
Get that advantage too.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I wasn't thinking that they would keep you out, but I was thinking that they would sort of put up a red flag that you.
That they have done. I don't think the first time I went after having been in those different countries, they just gave me the weirdest look. Here's this Jewish American girl who's been in Iran and Syria and Lebanon, like I was completely nuts.
They were CIA, right?
Yeah. So they were very suspicious, and they searched everything I had, and then they afterwards they just thought I was kind of crazy and weird. But then now it's even harder. Now I don't have a passport that has all those stamps because I have, a new passport. But I get much worse treatment. And these days when I get to the airport, everyone's, welcome to Israel, very nice until I get to the passport control. And I'm in the database. Mm-hmm. Database. It's very clear because as soon as they see my name, I'm sort of surrounded by 10 people who take me into a room and go through all of my possessions, sort of unwinding little mechanical pencils, like literally every single thing. As well as at times a strip search.
The power of the pen.
So there's this. That's right. That's right. So there's this very intense sort of screening and partially interrogation process that I have to go through now, simply because I document what's happening, and it's really it's very revealing that there is this incredible fear on the part of the Israeli authorities of anyone documenting what's happening. I don't know of an incident of an American peace activist ever being involved in attacking Israel, posing a genuine sort of threat to Israeli security. And yet they're taking these precautions. Clearly, there is some fear of what's happening getting out. If Israel is a democracy, as it loves to brag that it is, what is this kind of fascist sort of paranoia that has developed with regard to peace activists?
Well, they're trying to control the media and the information. It's widely done, as we know. We commented on here a lot in the U.S. itself, too.
Will you go back? And if so, what reception do you expect?
By the Palestinians or the Israeli authorities?
I was talking about the Israeli authorities.
I do intend to go back, hopefully, later this year. And I'm not sure. In fact, I'm a little worried. I think there's a breaking point at which they say, not only are we going to screen her, but we're actually going to prevent her from entering. And that's happened to a lot of my colleagues. And I'm a little fearful that will happen. And, imagine I'm a Jewish person who's prevented from entering, the Jewish state. Um, But and one of the reasons I'm fearful is that the last time I was in Palestine, I actually was traveling through a crossing that I'd crossed several times, a checkpoint, which had now been turned into one of these new terminals. I'm not sure if you've heard about these. I've kind of stepped up the sort of mobility limitations and installed these kind of terminals to replace certain checkpoints such that you arrive, you see no faces. There's just kind of a sort of red light, green light thing that goes on and off in front of a big kind of metal turnstile.
They're scanning your iris
and,
or something.
And
huh?
Basically, kind of, you hear a voice coming from a speaker somewhere that says, "Stop. Put down your bags. Walk through." You walk through, you hear a beep, you have to come back. You just kind of get barked at with these orders. It's incredibly dehumanizing. And I went through this, I was trying to cross through this terminal actually back to visit some Israeli friends in Tel Aviv. And the whole process was so humiliating that I got out my camera and started photographing it. And that really made them mad. So I'm a little fearful now that since I did that, they're going to...
My recollection is that's America's tax dollars directly at work. Wasn't there a provision where in dealing with the situation that the U.S. authorized money for to facilitate passage across the...
Precisely bound up with the Gaza withdrawal, I think. And it was Ms. Rice herself who said, you know, and since they're doing this we're going to help out, exactly, by making these terminals more secure and with up-to-date technology. I think that's exactly right.
So the listeners know, 3 to 5 billion American tax dollars go to Israel every year. That's a low estimate if you don't count independent contributions.
Right.
That's more than $10 million every day. That's going to Israel to support this occupation and these human rights violations. So, you know, even if this feels like something far away, has nothing to do with us, we have a role and a responsibility in this.
And money in the game, as you say. Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
One of the more striking images you have in your presentation, and I must say that your photographs really are breathtaking. I mean, you're a good photographer as well as everything else, because the images are vivid. I mean, I don't know when I've seen quite as good a collection of images of what the occupation really looks like. But in
the midst of it,
you have a map of checkpoints in the West Bank. Now, when we pick up a newspaper and read about checkpoints, I think the assumption is almost always that these are on the border between the West Bank, or on the Green Line, or related to it in some way, that it has to do with people crossing from the occupied territories into Israel, or for you, Israel into the occupied territories. What's so vivid about your map is that you show that that's not the case. The checkpoints are something else indeed.
That's exactly right. In fact, one of the first maps I show, because people are so shocked by it, is that you can see in this map of the permanently installed checkpoints that the checkpoints themselves are not on the sort of default de facto border between Israel and the occupied territories, but actually the vast majority of them within the Palestinian territories, within the West Bank, namely most of them between Palestinian towns and villages. So what that means is that a Palestinian person who wants to travel from his or her village or city to another town or city a few miles away, it could take them 4 hours to travel 2 miles, because they'll be stopped at checkpoints along the way, held up, sometimes detained, even strip searched. So in fact, you know, it brings to mind again this question of security, right? These institutions, the checkpoints, as well as the roadblocks and the other institutions I discuss in my presentation and book, are supposedly for the security and safety of the Israeli population. Meanwhile, what's happening is that, you know, ambulances on their way to a hospital are being prevented from crossing from a Palestinian village to a Palestinian city. Pregnant women, you know, on their way to the hospital can't go from their village to another Palestinian city if the soldiers won't let them. And so, you know, how is this contributing to the safety and security of Israelis, as opposed to a sort of method of control, keeping as tight control as possible?
Do they correlate with the aforementioned settlements and outposts generally?
To some extent, but not entirely. No, a lot of them seem to be, you have
entirely
cities like...
arbitrary, indeed.
I'm sure they're not arbitrary. I'm sure there's some sort of strategic value in placing them where that where they're placed, but it's not always with regard to where you have settlements or colonies. By the way, I'm trying to bring back this word colony, because it's interesting that in Hebrew and in English we have this kind of benign word settlement.
Yeah.
Or neighborhoods.
Exactly.
That's right, yeah.
In the newspapers they call them neighborhoods now. Whereas in many languages, French, for example, and others, they call them colonies.
Right.
I mean, there's no distinction made. This is a kind of colony. It's colonization. It's happened all over the world throughout history. Israel's not the first. We did it right here in the U.S.
Right.
of A. And I think it's I'm trying to teach myself and others to use colony. You know, don't be afraid.
The French, who's the writer I cite, but I haven't cited in long. He has a short book out. He's a French Jewish fellow. Starts with an R. Has a book out just called Israel, the Colonial Settler State, or something like that, where he. Very clearly, and they actually, in those days, they would translate it directly. So, but I'm trying to remember his name at this
point. I'm not sure who you mean. Yes.
Late and great.
We should we should point out that you're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Easterbrook and Paul Muth welcoming Anna Bolzer as our guest today. Anna has been in town giving presentations on her experience as a visitor to the occupied
Human rights worker, I like to
that's
say.
Okay, that's I was looking for a neutral term, particularly because your photographs, as I say, are so vivid. One sees what a visitor sees there.
I know, yeah, from experience that when people tell me something, you know, when people told me at the beginning, I didn't believe it. You have to see it. That's why the images are important. And I'd just like to mention that in my book, it's just full of color photographs. Almost every page you have these big color photos, and that's available on my website, which is annainthemiddleeast.com.
And your book is very nicely produced too. You told me it was printed in Turkey.
That's right. It's by published by Paradigm Publishers, but because of all the color photography, it was cheaper to do it abroad. And since I have ties in Turkey, we chose there. It came out great. Yeah.
I think so. I think it looks very nice. You mentioned earlier, Paul, the Brandeis issue. Are you familiar with that, Anna? That what happened there?
More or less. Why don't you go into it? Because I don't know, perhaps more than you.
Just one of a number of university-related questions that arose this week. An Israeli woman curated an art show, art done by Palestinian children.
Jewish Israeli student, actually, at Brandeis, from my understanding.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. Yeah. But is
Israeli woman.
She is Israeli.
Good context. Back
she was familiar with this group that was providing this art education and this school, really, for Palestinian children. Put up the exhibit in Waltham, Massachusetts, at Brandeis, and the university took it down. They packed up the exhibit, carted it off to MIT, and apparently hung it at MIT after that. But Democracy Now! This week included a conversation between the woman who put together the exhibit and an academic administrator who was from Central Casting.
I mean, egad, wasn't he awful?
It really should be, you know, they should record that and show that, you know, run that for academic administrators if you want to tell them how to do it according to the current routine, or if you want to tell people how to avoid losing your humanity as a university administrator. Don't be like this. He was amazing. He was just astonishing.
Speaking of photos on the web, if you go to the video version of that, she does reproduce some. You know, she has some pictures of the pictures too, so you can actually see what was so offensive as to need to be balanced with. Another point of view on Brandeis campus.
You know, I'm glad you bring up the story, because in fact it really shows that that there's a certain amount of censorship that happens in this country that doesn't even happen in Israel with regard to this conflict. You have a lot of Israelis, the majority of Israelis, who actually oppose the Jewish-only colonies built on Palestinian land. You have a majority of Israelis who are more or less against the occupation. And in Israel, there's a much sort of broader spectrum of dissent, debate on this issue than you find in this country, where the Jewish American and just American in general population seems quite polarized, but basically many of them very, very sort of sympathetic to the Israeli narrative without much sort of understanding of what Palestinians are going through. And I think it's very interesting that, you know, in Israel, this is up for discussion. You know, people talk about the occupation, whereas here you mention the word occupation and people gawk or Palestinian. What is a Palestinian? Palestinians don't exist. And it's
and
interesting.
Not consciously quoting Golda Meir, there, are they?
Right. People come to my talks to criticize, to undermine, to heckle me, and feel that they need to sort of protect, kind of defend the occupation and the interest of Israelis, not realizing that most Israelis actually are opposed on some level to what's going on right now. And I just think it's so interesting that in this country more is stifled than in Israel. And it, you know, you can read Haaretz, a mainstream left newspaper in Israel, and it's not perfect, but it has a lot more information, much more candid descriptions of what's happening than you'll find in any mainstream newspaper in the United States. And why is that? So that somehow here things are even more censored, and the population is even more to the right on this issue than in Israel itself.
This is an interesting point. Paul and I were arguing about a while ago. It was the Israeli press, not just Haaretz, but the Jerusalem Post and others, that pointed out how the Save Darfur campaign in this country was sponsored by representatives of the Israeli lobby, precisely to, as it were, get the pressure off complaints about the occupation and to excoriate another Muslim government.
To manipulate a real situation of crisis to their advantage, of course.
Put it in the context of the neocon plan, which has always included a general condemnation of Muslim-led governments around the central oil-producing region, so that we saw even liberal groups in this country carrying signs in the peace demonstration 2 weeks ago, out of Iraq into Darfur. Yes. It was only in the Israeli press that the real interest behind the pro-war rally in Washington and regarding Darfur were set out. It wasn't set out in the American paper.
To it. It's,
it was
a
set,
manipulation
it was set
going
out
on.
In the Jerusalem press and in Haaretz.
And we have the New Republic calling for U.S. troops to go in.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Very
right.
Directly this week with the whole dedication. Now, again.
And good liberals calling for NATO, yes. That's the Clintonian way.
Well, and it's curious that Condi Rice doesn't even want a Western force to go in. She wants to pay for some Bangladeshis to go in, which
so
I think
says,
is
right.
Which is which yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, no, I
make me do it. Make me do it.
Well, yeah. Yes, but you're also right that they want to do what the Clinton administration did in Serbia. That is, they want to attack the country and not use American troops on the ground. I mean, there's no interest in the Bush administration to get American troops in there, but they want American controlled forces, whether they be UN forces, whether under UN flag or the fallback position, NATO forces to do it.
You were attacked in the local press in the letters column, and somebody ended his remark defending Clinton's intervention in Kosovo and the area in the Balkans. Serbian murderers were eliminated one way or another.
Yeah, yeah, isn't that something?
It's a bloodthirsty approach.
Well, and of course, once again, this is we all know, and anyone who takes the trouble to look at what happened in Kosovo and Serbia and the Clinton administration knows perfectly well that the propaganda account that we were stopping genocide is just that. It wasn't true. In fact, the greatest depredations occurred in Kosovo after the NATO bombing began, as the NATO authorities said they knew would happen. So, I mean, it was a put-up job from the beginning, and it's disturbing the extent to which a leaf from that book has been taken in regard to Darfur.
Well,
they don't have much imagination in Washington. They have to repeat previous effects.
Well, they have such a well-established myth, the myth of Kosovo. We should have a UN blue helmeted standing peacekeeping force that would be available to do that, but the U.S. doesn't want to do it because it likes to be able to manipulate things.
And we also should be aware, I mean, as you've pointed out, Paul, the famous A Clean Break paper from 1996, the neocon Declaration of Independence, so to speak, listed quite candidly and openly the countries that should be rectified after Iraq. Iraq and Iran at the top of the list, and those included Syria, Lebanon, Somalia, and Sudan. And we found out this week that the U.S. is paying for a gang of thugs, basically, in Somalia that have produced what is essentially open warfare in Mogadishu for a week now. And this is straight out of the U.S. Treasury. This is the sort of operation, the special operations that the Pentagon is calling for, and it's basically to hire people to kill people.
But the U.S. Beat out the French for the oil contracts in Chad, so I don't think we're going to rectify Chad anytime soon.
Well, so long as Chad continues to follow orders. Yeah. I mean, as long as they play the game. Now, there's some difficulty about that. You'll find the Chadians somehow cast in a different light. I mean, we have, the move in this propaganda game that struck me as most amazing the last week or so is the new suggestion that Iran is receiving uranium from Venezuela. I mean, now the talk about repeating your effects. I mean, to have to do
who
the Niger yellow cake
who
again.
Who cooked up that memo?
Oh,
yeah.
Lord, you didn't you get in enough trouble with that first time round? I mean, and here they've got Venezuela as playing the Niger role vis-a-vis Iran.
But Iran just announced that they've discovered uranium on their own territory, so there isn't any need for it, even if it was going ahead. So
the Yukon publications will tell you that the Venezuelans put it there. You watch.
Yeah. Well, let's work our way back. There's some things, activity going on about Lebanon now. There's a UN resolution the U.S. has cooked up trying to ask Syria to declare their borders.
Hmm.
That's an irony in the Middle East when we have all the legacy of colonial borders and one of the major powers in the area hasn't declared their borders at all. So the borders have been declared by UN Resolution 242, but of course it's not an Article 7, so it's not enforceable by any means like sanctions or anything like that, holding back of aid.
The Israeli Prime Minister does say that he is going to draw the official borders of Israel, which
unilaterally.
This is
unilaterally, right? That's the thing.
Well, he said that he would declare them in like 5 years. And he would try to negotiate them, but if he wasn't able to,
right.
he was doing his best to not be able to. Uh-huh. So.
Mm-hmm. The question, of course, is where is he going to draw those borders? And it looks like those borders are going to be drawn around where the wall is. And the wall, by the way, to anyone who hasn't seen actually a map of it, which is many people because they're not published very widely, is not on the border where most people assume. If you're going to build a wall between two peoples, you build it on the border. If you have a neighbor you don't like, you build a fence on your property between your property and theirs. Well, where the wall is being built right now is actually sort of snaking through the West Bank. 80% of it doesn't even touch the border, but actually sort of weaves around, in effect annexing a lot of the key, first of all, land and key water sources in the West Bank. And so to say that somehow, kind of drawing those borders there deserves any kind of credit. I'm not going to give anyone a trophy for drawing their borders on somebody else's land. I mean, give me a break.
Didn't they also announce violation of human rights and international law? Bigger settlements like Ariel,
that's right,
et cetera, which are not contiguous, would not, I don't, Ariel is an outpost, right? It's not
Ariel. Ariel is now a full-fledged settlement. Although
it's not included by the wall directly.
It is included. Yeah. There is an sort of extension that is being built now. I've seen it being built, and that's one of the places where the wall literally weaves halfway east across the West Bank to get as many of these settlements onto the Israeli side of the wall. But don't be misled into thinking that they're simply just trying to get as many of the settlements as possible onto the Israeli side. Because actually, a lot of times, if you have a settlement and a Palestinian built-up area, they won't build the wall right up close to the settlement to just get it onto the Israeli side, but actually as close as possible to the Palestinian built-up area, villages, towns, and cities, to try so that all not only the settlement but all the land between the settlement
cut
and the nearest Palestinian built-up area
land,
also ends up on the Israeli side. In effect, taking all of that farmland and water sources away from those Palestinian areas, and that's exactly what's happening.
Water is extremely important. They found a way to pump out the Gaza. The Gaza has got the worst kidney failure in the world, because of the bad water they have, and the water table is going down so fast that salt water is innervating, so the shallow wells that Palestinians have are no longer usable. It's absolutely outrageous.
I should mention again, our guest is Anna Balzer, who has a book and a website, both of which worth looking at, Anna in the Middle East, on her experiences in the occupied territories. One of the things you showed once again quite vividly in your presentation, Anna, was the Qalqilya ghetto, and showing the other way in which the wall accomplishes social goals, we might say, gently. I mean, basically what it's done is wrapped three quarters of the way around a Palestinian area, so there's basically only one way in and out of it.
That's correct, yeah. What the wall is doing is, in addition to separating people from their land, is separating people from their communities. So Qalqilya is a typical example, a city of more than 50,000 Palestinians that has now been completely surrounded by this 25-foot concrete wall, such that there is one 6-foot-wide checkpoint, or it was about 6 meters perhaps, a checkpoint into and out of the city, the only means of getting out or in, and which can obviously be closed by soldiers or the army whenever it wants to. And Qalqilya, I mean, it used to be a very sort of a vibrant, bustling city, sort of a thriving, well, thriving to some extent, as much as one can under occupation, let's say, and is now pretty much dead. And if you look actually at the polls, Qalqilya used to be a strong, hardline Fatah city and has now become a hardline Hamas city. And, you know, there you go. It all says it right there.
Does it remind you of, actually, in history, would you say? Maybe I'll have you say it instead of me.
No, go ahead.
Well, I mean, what do you do when you round up and surround a inner city like that? You call it a ghetto, and what is it reminiscent of?
Well,
that's exactly what they are
calling
it. That was the term you used.
Calling it, instead of the Qalqilya city, the Qalqilya ghetto.
Yeah.
And absolutely, it brings to mind the Warsaw ghetto and the resistance happening in Palestine. Well, there was Jewish resistance too. There was a lot of that. What people just don't know about this wall is just the way it's just separating people from each other. Families literally separated by this wall. Children separated from their schools. People separated from their work. Sick people separated from their hospitals. I mean, that is the reality of what this wall is actually accomplishing. This idea that it's for security. If it's for security, build it on your border. If it's for security, don't maximize the amount of land and water that you take away. This is not about security. It's about maintaining control over that land and water sources.
Yeah. You started last night, Anna, with an interesting and important point. It's one that we almost take for granted, I think, here, but probably does need to be repeated again and again in the discussion in the U.S., and that is the assumption amongst otherwise well-educated Americans that this problem is intractable because it represents age-old religious hatreds. And you started with that, and maybe worthwhile to say something about it.
That's right. A lot of people think it's kind of this ancient rivalry between Jews and Muslims that has been going on forever and will continue forever because, you know, at its heart are these sort of deep religious differences. And one of the first realizations that one has going over there is that for the most part, this really is not a war about religion. This is a war about land, about water, about resources, territory. And that becomes quite clear when you get there, seeing the policies that have been adopted. For example, Palestinian Christians, 10-15% of the Palestinian population is Christian, and they are persecuted, discriminated against as their Muslim counterparts. It's not about, you know, the majority of a Jewish Israeli population is secular. And you know, this is not about religion. This is about territory, colonialism, imperialism.
That last point that you made is worthwhile, too. The majority of the Jewish Israeli population is secular. I mean, this is, you know, they're not fighting about the Torah. They're fighting about land, eh?
That's right.
And with that in mind, I wonder if you must have been asked recently on this on the lecture tour you're doing right now, the question of the Mearsheimer-Walt report must come up frequently. I mean, this is the report done by academics at University of Chicago and Harvard's Kennedy School about the Israeli lobby in the U.S., published, written for an American publication that, in illustration of a point that you were making earlier, refused to publish it. The American journal, The Atlantic, I think, refused to publish the thing. It was published a summary of the complete academic paper was published in the London Review of Books, but it's caused a lot of comment. It's been attacked by the usual people as anti-Semitic. What it is an investigation of the influence on American policy of the Israeli lobby. What happens? What do you hear in discussions? What do people ask you? How does this come up in your presentations?
Well, first I want to respond to this claim of anti-Semitism. I get this a lot. Although since I'm Jewish, they can't call me an anti-Semite, so they call me a self-hater.
Self-hating Jew,
instead.
Sure. Yes, yes.
But it's so offensive to me as a Jewish person that people would equate occupation, oppression, discrimination with Judaism. I mean, these things have nothing to do with each other, and to criticize, you know, to call out when one sees discrimination is not anti-Semitic. It's absurd and offensive. So this happens all the time. It's kind of moral blackmail, sort of trying to silence people. It's very dangerous to create this kind of blind spot where people are actually afraid of speaking out because they're afraid of being called an anti-Semite. And just to bring up that point again, this is not about Judaism and Islam for the most part, but this is about human rights and international law. And it doesn't surprise me one bit that they've been criticized as anti-Semites simply for objectively looking at, or maybe it's objective, maybe it's targeting, focusing in on what the Israeli government is doing, and also with regard to the Israel lobby, which was the topic of the article.
What about any special levers to push in Washington and other places? Have you talked to many politicians at the federal level, or?
I've made a few efforts. I've talked to the chief of staff of a congressperson or two, and actually, interestingly, the ones I've talked to have all been very.
Invite you to a party at the Watergate? Or?
Not yet. They've been quite sort of even sympathetic, saying, "Well, we understand what you've experienced, and we agree, you know, to some extent, but there's no way we'll ever talk about it because, as it is, because of this Israel lobby, it's become basically political suicide to do anything but stand with the kind of status quo with regard to Israel, or you become even more supportive of Israel because of the Israel law, the pro-Israel lobby. And by the way, I don't call it Jewish lobby because,
yes,
again, it's not only Jewish people. There are Christian Zionists. There are weapons manufacturers that are all pining for Israel getting this strong financial support from the U.S.
That's an important point. We really should underline that. I mean, because I think that point has even been lost in some of the discussion of the Mearsheimer-Walt report, that the Israeli lobby includes these other groups, including weapons manufacturers, folks who are concerned about American policy, American control of Middle East resources, and see Israel as the cop on the beat for the U.S. in that regard. The Israeli lobby is a very broad sort of notion. In fact, there are some who say it gets so broad that the concept isn't very useful, because there is such a collection of elements that make up the Israeli lobby.
And Carl, you and I have identified ourselves with the idea that the other forces, such as munitions, such as oil interests, such as the grand strategy people, mm-hmm. are perhaps more important than any single one of the, and maybe even the total of the Jewish leaders, B'nai B'rith, any of the organizations that are specifically Jewish. That the, of course, Chomsky goes back to Suez and says that if Israel does something that the U.S. Doesn't like, it'll pull the rug out immediately. Of course, that was a collusion with British and France, who in post-World War II environment were sort of our then adversaries, because the U.S. was wanting to dominate with its Pax Americanus, right?
Very good point. I mean, I think it's I think that the strength of the pro-Israel lobby can hardly be overestimated, and yet I think that ultimately that may not be the root so much as mentioned, sort of U.S. interests. I mean, yes. Not only financially, because by the way, of that $3 to $5 billion we give to Israel, 2/3 of it is earmarked to come back into this country in weapons purchases, and is going into the pockets of weapons manufacturers and corporations in this country, but it actually sort of more imperialistic as well interest that the U.S. has, that it's not, one thing about that article, the Israel lobby, was that it implied somehow that it is not in U.S. interests to be supporting Israel, right, as we have been, and I'm not sure I agree. I think that
Not U.S. interests, but dominant class.
Well, once again, there's always an ambiguity.
Not the average American.
Always ambiguity when we say U.S. interest, because we rarely mean the full population of the United States.
Exactly.
What we mean are dominant social groups, dominant economic groups.
It has
in this
that
country.
Added irony that it also U.S. is us. So.
In a democratic polity where we're supposed to have control over it, the contradiction should be clear. But I think that your point on it is an extremely important one, that the issue that has arisen out of the Mearsheimer-Wolt paper has been, is this Israeli lobby, however accurately described, taking American policy in a direction, as it were, it does not want to go? Is it moving it in a way that is not in the interests of the dominant social groups in the U.S.? And the answer to that seems to be no. That is, it is those... The question of whether the tail is wagging the dog here seems to suggest that the dog is still firmly in control, and that what the dog is, besides a dog of war, is American geopolitical and economic interests. And when we say American, we mean, of course, those dominant social groups.
Mm. We might get back to the... if you had any comments,
because
on
so many of
Larry
these,
Franklin, of the, there are so many other things.
Yeah,
going
so
on.
Many of the things that we want to talk about, anyhow, circle back
wound,
to this issue.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean,
it's so central.
Everything is connected, as the old mantra has it. But I mean, when we talk about the central role that Israel plays in American at the heart of American foreign policy, which has to do with the control of Mideast oil, Mideast energy, it's hard to get away from it. Now, one thing that another reason the Mearsheimer-Wolt thing has been criticized is that they, in fact, deny that point. If they deny that it is American, that the bedrock of American foreign policy is control of Mideast energy resources, and for that reason, then they are, as it were, free to say that Israeli interests take over from the real interests of American foreign policy. But I mean, that denial can't stand.
Yeah,
that's simply nonsense.
You just have to drive down the street and look at the gas price and realize that part of that is an increment that has to do with so-called instability.
Well,
obviously, we know that people are using that as a ruse to jack the prices.
We
and
need
make,
to be careful.
Money,
we need to be careful about that a little bit, though. I mean, because this gets into the question of access and control of access to, as opposed to control of Mideast oil resources. We hear more nonsense this week about how we have to produce more ethanol, which will wean the U.S. away from Mideast oil. Well, in fact, the U.S. gets very little oil from the Middle East. It was much more important that there was an explosion in a Nigerian pipeline this week in terms of the actual supply of oil into the United States.
That was
the U.S.
concern, an internal gasoline pipeline, though, actually,
but,
as opposed to oil.
But the point, but I'm talking about Nigerian oil industry is far more important to American supplies, American access to oil, than is any Middle East source. The distinction has to be made between access to Middle Eastern oil and the control over it, which the U.S. insists upon, mainly as a way of controlling our major economic economic competitors, Europe and Northeast Asia.
But the price is international, and from Venezuela, if we didn't get it from Venezuela, we'd have to get more from the Middle East. If they decided to destabilize Chavez again and shut down his distribution system or something like that, or if I think the markets were probably more disturbed by this assassination of an oil executive in
Nigeria
than this internal gas pipeline blowing up.
Well, it certainly did push the price of oil up well over $70, so it's it has an importance there. But the problem is that there is so much discussion at various levels and from various groups in this country about how we the U.S. has to wean itself from Middle Eastern oil. The oil's got to go someplace. The U.S. will not not be a not be bereft of oil, regardless of what political reorganization takes place. What is possible is that the U.S. control over world energy resources could decline, and that's what really scares them in Washington. Our guest this hour has been Anna Baltzer, who is on a tour of quite an extensive tour. Anna, how many months you're on?
More
this?
Than 3 months it's
Good
been
heavens.
Now, yeah.
Where do
Almost
you go
100
next?
Talks. I'm heading today to St. Louis, and then on from there through Missouri, Arkansas, and Kansas, and then back into Colorado where I started this tour. So I'm on the tail end right now.
Oh. Okay. Well, anybody know people down in St. Louis?
Yeah, if people want details,
contact.
My website
is itinerary's got it. Yeah.
It's annaintheMiddleEast.com. That's ANNA in the Middle East, all one word, .com. And on there, in addition to being able to see the photographs and writings that I've put together with my work, there's also information about my presentations, my tour schedule, ways of inviting me if you'd like in your class or your community to invite me to come speak. You can do that there. And you can get details on those presentations coming up, as well as ordering my DVD and book and emailing me. So that, again, is annaintheMiddleEast.com.
Great.
And thank you very much, Anna, for being with
thank
us today.
You.
I was
going
to go down to St. Louis again because Scott Simon, my nemesis on public radio,
National Public Radio was supposed to be down there giving
a little book talk, and I was thinking about...
You should go down and raise some questions.
Yeah,
yes, I think that would be
yeah.
delightful. Well, there's all sorts of things to hear in St. Louis, I guess.